Tonight on Arena, Billie Holiday and Billie Eilish both feature in our movie reviews this evening, and Moya Cannon gives us old work and new in her collected poems. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start with films this evening for your streaming consideration. We have Tale of Two Billies, as I've been telling you. One, Billie Holiday, the legendary jazz singer who was persecuted to the end by the powers that be. And the other, Billie Eilish, the green-haired pop sensation who means more to your teenagers probably than she does to you. But maybe this Apple documentary will change all of that. And we delved into the lengthy arthouse documentary I Walk on Water. John Maguire, Angela Flannery have been watching the movies and they join me now. We'll start with The United States versus Billie Holiday, directed by Lee Daniels and stars R&B singer Andra Day in the role of Billie Holiday here. Hugely difficult role to take on as what I think is probably her first acting role, a very early acting role. Let's get a sense of where we are, first of all, in the life of Billie Holiday. What part of her life is being told here, Angela?
Sean, it focuses, I suppose, really on the last 12, 15 years of her life, but at a point where they want her to stop singing the song Strange Fruit, and she is refusing to do it. So really this, as you said, you know, how she was persecuted by the authorities, the FBI want her to stop, and they set the Narcotics Bureau on her because they know she's a drug user, you know, under the guise of, well, look, you're a drug user, but really underneath it all, if she would just stop singing the song Strange Fruit, which, as we know, is about a lynching, and there's a lot of civil rights upheaval and civil rights marches, etc., and they see it as her inciting civil unrest, and she just says no and insists on singing it, you know, at cabaret joints, venues, Carnegie Hall, and they persecute her as a result of it. So it tells that story. That's the idea. Her as a civil rights hero, as opposed to a torch song singer.
And John, while the whole idea is that she's not to sing this song, it's not just the FBI who are putting pressure on her not to sing it. It's those close to her as well.
Well, that's the story that Daniels is trying to tell here, which is the kind of pressures that she was under from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics chief Harry Anslinger, who would have come out of Prohibition. That organization came from the Federal Bureau of Prohibition. And they have their deeply racist individual played by Garrett Hedlund. Having connected her protest song to these supposed riots that she was inciting and looking for a high profile target for that newly minted war on drugs, she's a heroin addict medicating herself, according to Daniel's story, to overcome the pain of childhood abuse. So he sends a black federal agent and a former soldier called Jimmy Fletcher, played by Trevante Rhodes, to infiltrate her inner circle, present himself as a fan, and then betray her as she's got this very tight entourage of people who have been with her for decades and a succession of bad husbands and bad managers and people who are abusing her and treating her badly. But soon enough, Billie Holiday is in jail and on her release finds herself falling in love with the man who put her there and who is still working for Anslinger, even though she doesn't know it.
Yeah. Let's get a sense, though, of those, that entourage around her, as you say, John. James Monroe is the husband in this particular, at this point in time, played here by Eric Larrey Harvey. And also in the mix is the talent agent, Joe Glazer, played by Dusan Ducic. And Billie has been asked not to sing Strange Fruit. And as you'll hear Andra Day express in this particular section, she very colourfully and with some very harsh language tells them where they can go with that idea.
Your friend Anslinger's in the paper again.
He ain't no friend of mine.
Sure he is. Glazer's friend too, right?
I cut Strange Fruit.
No, Joe, I want to sing the damn song, all right? The club advertises it. People pay good money to come here and hear me sing it.
I've told you 100 times, people in high places don't want you singing that song.
And I've asked you over 100 times, what people, Joe? What you looking at him for? Shit, I'm no one pays you.
The government.
Yeah, the government. People like your buddy Anslinger, right?
Wait a minute with that, huh?
The song means a lot to me, Joe.
Mirpal wrote it, and he's a fucking commie.
Come on. I don't care, all right? It's important to me.
You ain't singing that song.
I sing it the fuck I want.
The lady wants to sing a song, and we should sing a song.
He gives a face to them, her boy's being lynched.
Mind your business, Freddy. Look, bitch, we ain't going through this again.
Yeah, well, if you all ain't Anslinger's friends, how can you be sitting with him every night?
What do you expect us to do, huh? Run from the man? I'm trying to protect your ass.
Don't lie to me.
I ain't lying.
I'm scratching it. It's for your own good, okay?
Wonderful group of individuals there. Billie Holiday, played by Andra Day, and the wonderful group, including James Monroe, the husband, played by Eric Larrey Harvey, and Joe Glazer, the talent agent, played by Dusan Ducic. We really get a sense of the men around her. They're not a nice bunch at all. Never mind the FBI, Angela.
No, they're not. I mean, she can't trust anybody. And, you know, this is to anyone who knows anything about Billie Holiday, this isn't news. You know, she had absolutely terrible taste in men, and they manipulated her and used her and, abused her. Lots of violent relationships. All of that is in this film. Andra Day is quite amazing in this, I thought. I think she saves the film, to be honest. She makes the film. Her performance, what you hear there, the accent, she occupies this role. There isn't that much archival audio of Billie Holiday speaking, but yet she manages to sort of create this character who's utterly believable, foul-mouthed, chain-smoking, you know, hard-drinking, and she is just mesmerising on screen. And of course, her voice is incredible as well. That's a great clip. There's many great clips of her in action. The whole thing about the men, it does seem to dominate the narrative here. I would have preferred if they had focused on the setup and the FBI and all of that.
Yeah, and the other side of things here is, John, she's an R&B singer, Andra Day, and she performs the Billie Holiday songs and performs them really well.
Yeah, it's an uncanny approximation of Holiday's uniquely raspy singing voice. And the longer the film goes on, the raspier that voice gets. The ability for Day, not Lady Day, but Andra Day, to approximate that and progress that as the story progresses, I thought was exceptional. Her voice is just superb. Mm. And like Angela says, she carries the film over all the lumps and bumps, because this is a Lee Daniels film. It's disjointed. It's emotionally unsteady. It's prone to soap opera melodramatics and quick as a wink changes in tone. And the film would have benefited, and Andra Day's performance would have benefited, I think, from a steadier and less florid hand. But there's no denying the power of the songs and Day's breakthrough performance, genuine power and empathy. I thought she was superb in a mediocre film. She really stands out.
Yeah, and it goes on. I think it's well over the 2 hour mark. That prune that John is talking about there, Angela, do you think it would have benefited from that as well?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. Because as John said, the tone does keep shifting. It seemed like there were 4 or 5 different movies squashed into this. You know, there's the love story in there. There's, you know, it's the biopic where we have to go back into her, her childhood and what caused her to be the way that she is and all the problems that she has. So there's all these flashbacks, and there's weird stylistic jumps into kind of heroin induced hallucinations that allow us to flash back to the to her youth. And then she witnesses a lynching, but actually Billie Holiday never did. I felt like there was an awful lot of poetic license around the relationship with Jimmy Fletcher, cutaways to interviews with a journalist. There's a lot of different styles in here. It felt really, really bloated, but yet it was a film I liked because I really like this story. It's a really important story, and Andra Day's performance, I think, carried it. But yeah, it's overblown.
Well, how does that translate into stars from you, first of all, then, Angela?
Oh, I would give 5 to Andra Day, but 3 to the film.
5 to Andra Day, 3 to the film. I think you might be in a very similar camp as Angela on this one, John.
I do. I agree with Angela completely on it. Back in 1972, Diana Ross made her debut playing Holiday in Lady Sings the Blues, and she got an Academy Award Best Actress nomination for that. And I think it'll happen again for Andra Day for this. But it's a 3-star movie with like Angela says, a 5-star performance.
All right, that's Billie Holiday, The United States versus Billie Holiday, the title of the first film we're speaking about this evening. Let's move on then to the other film dealing with a Billie, this time a documentary film, Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. For those who are, I don't know what stone they've been living under, but if they don't know who Billie Eilish is or what Billie Eilish has achieved in a phenomenally short period of time, how would you describe that, Angela?
Well, she's a teenage American singer-songwriter who, I suppose, rose to fame about, what, 18 months ago? But within a year of people knowing who she was, managed to win 6 Grammys. Well, she won 5. Her brother Phineas won one of them at last year's Grammys for her debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? She is really original. You know, she wears these enormous baggy clothes. You'd recognise her if you don't know who she is. You know, huge big hoodies and has green and black hair and is kind of grungy looking, but is very clean living and has an incredible voice. But managed to produce this debut album in her bedroom or her brother's bedroom in Los Angeles in her parents' very ordinary house, and is a totally normal teenager and adored by millions. Millions. And she's 67 million followers on Instagram.
Yeah. And I think at one point in the movie, her father points out she had 1 million followers a year ago. And suddenly a year later, she had so many more followers involved. John, I guess not too different from myself, you wouldn't necessarily expect yourself to be in the demographic for this particular film.
What are you implying, Sean?
That you're not a teenage girl.
Spring chicken when it comes to that. Look, talent is talent, and mm-hmm. that's what this film is about, really. And more than that, R.J. Cutler, who directed the September issue a few years ago, where he followed Anna Wintour in the preparation of her Vogue magazine, the issue of the year for the Vogue magazine, he got in on the ground floor here. We have, right from the start of the production of the album, just when they're starting to write the songs, he's there in this back bedroom in a suburban LA home with Eilish has a scribbled notebook of lyrics and a microphone, and Phineas, the brother, has a keyboard and a computer, and they make music. She writes the lyrics, he writes the tunes. They're like Bacharach and David for Generation Z, and they seem like lovely kids. That's what's so great about this film, yeah, is that they seem so nice and, like Angela says, so ordinary. And the parents, Maggie, who was an actress, and bearded Patrick, the father, who's a total dude, they try to keep them grounded with lots of support and wise words and home-cooked meals. And you really get the sense in the first half of the film that something is going to happen. Yeah. And then in the second half of the film, it happens, and it happens fast.
Yeah, well, let this just hold up.
A real insight into the pace of modern culture and the speed of pop.
Yeah, just
is
hold,
what this film really impressed on me.
Yeah, we'll hold off on what happens in the second half of the film just for the time being, because Angela, that first half, even John mentioned it there, the parents, talk about an example. If you want to parent your children brilliantly, watch this couple. If you want siblings to have a brilliant relationship, watch this brother and sister. And none of it in your face. They're homeschooled, the two children, by the parents, obviously. None of it in your face. Somehow they come across like the people next door who have a very talented son and daughter.
Yeah, I found myself taking parenting notes. I'll be honest about it. I was just sitting there going, this is how you do it. You know, I mean, I'm homeschooling a teenager myself, and I was thinking I should be more like the Barrett O'Connells. Everything would be fine. They're lovely. They're just lovely people. I did not expect to enjoy watching this, but there's something very slow moving and mesmerizing about it. And being in their house where they're doing the laundry and they're having disagreements and the father's picking up after the dog in the garden and the mother's going around kind of, you know, quietly giving advice and then doing pieces to camera where she's, you know, sort of being quite philosophical about how teenagers are getting a hard time, but look at the times they have to grow up in. But it's all very quiet and, you know, normal. These two kids were homeschooled, and I kind of thought, God, they did an amazing job on them. Yeah. I mean, really, compared to what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. No Zoom lessons, no nothing, just mommy and daddy and lots of dancing and singing. This academic side of things, let's forget about that. And well, if the proof of the pudding is in the eating, I guess they kind of have proved their point with their daughter and son's success. Let's listen to a clip from the film, Billie Eilish speaking about her relationship with her fans. She didn't even like that word, as you'll hear in this clip, which was filmed in 2018.
My Lucifer is lonely.
No, that's the song, Sean. Is that right? Oh, yes, this is what I was looking for. Here we are.
My I look into the crowd and I see all these faces, so many different feelings and heartbreak, and every single person in there, you know, is going through something good or bad or horrible or amazing, you know? And the least I can do is make art that I make because I have the same problems. I don't think of them as fans, ever. They're not my fans, they're like part of me.
There you go. Billie Eilish on her relationship with her fans. And that's from the documentary we're speaking about this evening. Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. So, John, you were saying to us that in the first half, we get this extraordinary rise to success. What then, what starts to happen as things become, you know, the success becomes ginormous?
Well, like you say, Sean, it all seems to happen and all at once. She has millions of album sales, billions of video views, an armful of Grammy Awards. We see all of that happen. She gets to record the new James Bond theme song. Herself and Phineas sit in the back of a tour bus and record a demo for that. And one of the curious things in the second half of the film is her relationship with her idol, Justin Bieber. And we flash back to 2.5 years previous, and she's standing in front of a wall of posters of Bieber. Then Bieber calls her and asks to collaborate on a remix of one of her first songs, and then calls her again and again, meets her eventually backstage at Coachella, the big music festival where she's one of the headline acts. And that relationship, I think, was really key to just how she's still only 17 or 18 years of age. And Bieber admonishes her, warns her basically that it's going to all go by in a flash. And I thought that was a really interesting relationship, and how Cutter worked that into the story of this extraordinary success. She went from absolutely nowhere to releasing a few tracks on a SoundCloud, on the SoundCloud website, to being one of the biggest pop acts in the world in a incredibly short period of time.
And the other
sheer pace of her stardom, that velocity, is really interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is, Angela, you know, the Justin Bieber thing, she shows us at one point, or she's doing a radio interview, and she shows the guys a video of herself as a 12-year-old. She was absolutely, as a 12-year-old would be, of her particular vintage, she was in love with Justin Bieber. It wasn't just a fan, she was totally and absolutely in love with him. And she's able to understand, as the slightly older teen, exactly what was going on in her teen, in her 12-year-old head. But the thing that really struck me about this film was the creative process, the simplicity of it between herself and her brother.
Yeah, I absolutely loved that part of it. I mean, I'm sitting there in the bedroom with them while they're doing it. You know, he has to drag her into the room to get her to sit down and to focus, because he's kind of the nerdy part of it where he wants to sit down and he's got his, you know, sound editing software up and he's got everything hooked up to it and all the machinery. And he's like, come on, we're going to lay down some tracks. And she's like, no. She's quite a bit younger. I think she's about 5 years younger than him. But then she starts singing and her voice is just exquisite. They start harmonizing. And I'm sitting there kind of looking at this going, you know, it sounds like Chet Baker to me. How can it actually sound like that? It's so modern. But they're, you know, they're just incredibly talented, and their collaboration, they can just shadow each other. They know each other so well. There's no competition. There's no jealousy. It was really kind of towards when it starts changing towards the end, you know, she's becoming huge and the record company guys are coming in and the lawyers and the publicists, and she injures herself on stage and they make her go back out there. Not because they don't want to disappoint the fans, because it's going to cost them a fortune if she doesn't perform. And you know that watching it, and you wonder, are this family going to be torn apart because she's such a brand now? And you get that kind of sinking feeling, you know.
I really hope they're not, because what comes across is this wonderful family. Although we do, much should say, for her 17th birthday, she gets a car. So it's not that normal, really, unless you've got a lot of money in your bank account. However, overall, quite a long documentary coming in at 2 hours and 20 minutes. Didn't feel like that to me. Did it feel like that to you, John, and stars?
No, it all is, like I say, it's the velocity of the thing. It all seems to happen. The second half of the film, certainly, it all seems to happen in 5 minutes. And that reaction to manufactured pop, herself and Phineas are the whole band, But I found myself wishing that the director Cutler would have pressed on and maybe have somebody else come in and make a case for her extraordinary artistic vision to slow down long enough really to contemplate it more completely, where her ideas come from, where her video concepts come from, and her branding and her visual image that she presents. So it's 4 stars for me, really only at a very minor point really, but I would have wanted a little more analysis of where this woman is coming from.
Yeah, and then
so 4 stars for me. But if you're into it, it's a must see.
Yeah,
if you're into it,
we got the analysis. We'd also know how to homeschool our children to be stars. And what are you saying, Angela?
Well, I want to say first of all that she didn't just get a car; she got a Dodge Challenger. She got a muscle car for her 17th birthday. I was like, God, I want to go for a ride with this girl, you know. But I'm not going to give it 4 stars. I thought it was more of a 3-star movie. If you're a Billie Eilish fan, you're going to end up watching this on a loop and give it a million stars. People will love it.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to our final movie then. Another documentary. This time, I'm calling it a documentary. I don't know if that's how we can describe Khalik Allah's film "I Walk on Water." Centres on the street. On the streets, rather, and the filmmaker's own neighbourhood of East Harlem in New York City. What story is he telling here, John? Doesn't summarise it. What's he doing here, the filmmaker, Khalik Allah?
Well, we earned our salt, I think, with this one, Sean, because it runs 3 hours and 20 minutes and it evades simple taxonomy. Is it an autobiography? Is it a documentary? Is it an ethnography? Is it an art film for a gallery space, which is what it feels like for most of it? Or is it a bizarre rambling monologue from a person under the influence of magic mushrooms, which he is for quite long periods, the second half of it? It's a lot to take on. I Walk on Water, both as an interpretative text and as a collision of visual styles and narrative strings and the sheer noise level inside this man's head. And you have to wonder, not only like you wonder, is it a documentary, but you have to wonder who is it for other than Khalik Allah himself. And I thought maybe perhaps more suited to what I said, like a gallery installation, than watching it at home.
Let's listen to a clip. Frenchie is a man who's featured in previous films, a previous film of Allah's. And here the filmmaker Allah introduces this homeless Haitian man called Frenchie to us, who's one of his subjects and a major part of this film.
So Frenchie, you and I have been working together since around 2012. This is now 2019. So we're looking at like 7 years I've been working with you, taking photographs. What do you think about the work that I do with you, man? Because a lot of people want to hear it from you. They want to know what you think about me taking your picture, putting you in books, putting you in movies. What do you think about all of that?
I think that's the best thing that I ever have to see in my life. Because with that, I feel like everything is easy for me right now. And I can see everybody in life have a way. The way human beings live is the way that I must live. That's the best way.
That's Frenchie, one of the main subjects of I Walk on Water, the new film from Khalik Allah. An installation is probably the best way of describing this, really, as John did there. That's where it would work best, Angela?
Yeah, I absolutely felt that it did, because that it would work that way. Khalik Allah is an incredibly talented photographer. I'm not sure that it translates into film. I mean, the images are really arresting. And, you know, he doesn't use flash photography. He goes out and films at night deliberately, and he uses whatever available light there is. So when you're talking about being up on the corner of Lexington and 125th Street, that's, you know, phone boxes and liquor store lights and, you know, flashing cop sirens. And these are the kind of lights. That's the effect that he gets.
And really what it gives us is it's an impressionistic view of this rather than a documentary view of it.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, it's the same, doesn't it? Like even the audio in it, it's all wild track that he's recorded from around the place. And even the voiceovers, he's not actually filming the portraits, the people that, you know, are talking. He's recording the voice track separately. So I did wonder, you know, are they even aware that this is going to be a film? So, but look, it's very complex. You'd need an hour to go into it.
Stars, what would you give it?
I'd give it two. I felt like it was a vanity project. And actually, he's already made this. His previous one-hour film, which featured Frenchie mostly, called Field Niggas, was actually a much better film and exactly the same thing, but without all of his own ramblings in it. It's an ego project.
An ego project, two from Angela. And what are you saying briefly, John? How many stars?
Context is everything, Sean. If I had seen it in a gallery, I would certainly have circled around and watched more of it. And even the clip you play there sounds sensible and it sounds complete and whole and entire, but there's nothing else. 90% of this film is kind of inane and rambling, and watching it all at once is too much. So it was just one star for me. I couldn't get into it.
All right, one star. So we want to see it in a gallery. I Walk on Water seems to be the consensus there. And before that, we were speaking about Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry, and the United States versus Billie Holiday. John McGuire and Angela Flannery are reviewers this evening. Moya Cannon is one of the great Irish poets. She has just published her collected poems, which includes work from six previous collections and a handful of new poems. The natural world, our relationship with it and our primal responses to its beauty, provides inspiration for much of her work. Music, history and archaeology are also important. And I'm delighted to welcome Moya onto Arena to celebrate this landmark collection. Congratulations, first of all, Moya, on the collected poems. Almost all of the poems, in fact, from your six previous collections are there, beginning with Oars from 1990 right up to Donegal Tarantella from 2019. What were your... Let's go back, though, to the younger poet. What were your concerns back with that first collection, and how have they changed over the years?
Well, Sean, it's hard to say. I'm a little bit like these older people who are about 40 or 50 or 60 whom you used to hear when you were 16 saying, I feel just the same now as I did then. I have a lot of the same preoccupations, actually. The first collection, a lot of it was written after I'd moved to Galway. And I spent a lot of time in the Burren in North Clare. And so a lot of the poems are sort of located in that area, and just the enchantment of limestone and all the secrets which limestone holds, and the beautiful little medieval churches of that area sort of open it up. But it's full of the turmoil of those years as well, and the kind of emotional roller coaster of those years between, I suppose, 20 and 30 or earlier. So a lot of that is in it as well.
And the preface the preface to the book quotes Veslava Szymborska talking about inspiration. Whatever inspiration is, it is born from a continuous I don't know. Now, do you see that search to answer the question with something other than I don't know? Is that what the poems are about in some ways, Moya?
I often think that a poem is actually, it's an extended exercise in wondering. Just wondering aloud, you're sort of looking at something, and there's a very famous poem by Wallace Stevens, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, where you're looking at things from many angles, and you don't, unlike a mathematical problem, you don't have to come down on one side or other at the end. So you don't have to find the answer, but you sort of explore, it's like a cave, you explore all sorts of little avenues. And the exploration itself is of great interest, really.
Well, interesting that you bring up caves there, because the first poem that I want you to read, in fact, which comes from your third collection, Carrying the Songs from 2007, Chauvet, a direct reference to caves here.
Yes, this is a very, very famous cave which was discovered in France in, I think, 92. And it was a cave with wonderful cave paintings. And they invited the art critic John Berger to come down into it. And as he said himself, I was invited in to say, wow. And he said it very, very eloquently. They discovered these were much, much older than any paintings they'd found before. Places like Lascaux were 20,000 years old, the paintings. And in these, they were 32,000 years old. And he went down to copy the drawings. And he said, you know, we haven't got any better at drawing since.
It's an amazing statement, isn't it?
Which just astonished me, that art is so old. And, you know, when you think of how young writing is, such a young art, really. It's only 5,000 years old or so. But 32,000 years ago, people were making these perfect, perfect paintings. And you can walk through the cave. Because there's a virtual tour. If you look up Chauvet, C-H-A-U-V-E-T, there's a fantastic virtual tour you can take through it.
Well, bring us on your aural tour now with the poem Chauvet.
I will indeed. So this is Chauvet for John Berger. One red line defining his rump draws the small mammoth out of the cave wall, renders him more than a stalagmite. In another chamber, a bear's paw protrudes, outlined in charcoal. The animals had been in the wall all along, awaiting recognition, release. The Stone Age artists knew it, just as the Italian master would know it, as his chisel unlocked perfect forms from Carrara's marble. As we know it, when some informed, deft gesture, a tilt in a melody, a lit line in a poem or a song, draws us out into our humanity, warm-blooded, bewildered.
Moya Cannon with her poem Chauvet, and that's from her third collection, Carrying the Songs, from 2007. And Moya speaking to us this evening on the occasion of the publication of her collected poems. Most of the poems, I said in my introduction, survived into the collected poems. Were there just some that you when you looked at them in the cold light of day, Moya, that you thought, I'd rather not?
There were a few. A few from the earlier collections, which I had actually done a new and selected about in 2007, in which I'd included my first two collections and then some new poems. And that was called Carrying the Songs. And I had left out a number of maybe less than a third, perhaps, of the two earlier collections. But I restored two or three of them actually for this. I said, no, they should really have been in there.
Right, okay. So, some didn't survive a second call, and some were reinstated, as it were.
Yes.
One of the things that was said about those early collections, one of the critics spoke about a prayer-like quality that was there. Can you see that now when you look back, or were you even aware of it at the time?
I think poetry and prayer probably aren't too far apart in certain respects. You know, they're kind of about, very often there's the stress between what is and what might be in any work of literature. And I suppose that's part of the quality of prayer as well. And perhaps also trying to tilt something towards possibility. There's a great American poet called Denise Levertov. She lived in America, called Denise Levertov. She was actually born in Wales, or she was Welsh and Ukrainian background, I think. But she was saying that the poets must give us a vision of hope to counter the familiar vision of disaster. And I think that's true. She was very political herself, actually, and very much a political activist through all her life. I think she went to Korea during the war, etc.
You might read another poem for us from Carrying the Songs, again, part of the collected poems, obviously, that we're speaking about. This is a poem called Pollen. Will you introduce it for us before you read it, Moya?
Sure. I was out for a walk one day with a friend and bumped into another botanist friend, Micheline Sheehy Skeffington, and she was terribly excited. She said she was just back from Inishere in the Aran Islands, and they had taken a core. She's a paleobotanist. She looks at sort of what used to grow in places, basically, what's left in the soil. And they'd taken a core sample from under a lake, a very deep core sample, and found what had been growing in the Aran Islands back to the Ice Age. And they found evidence of oak, for instance, which was quite surprising. And they'd found the pollen. And we were saying, gosh, isn't it extraordinary that pollen would have survived? And she said, pollen is very tough stuff. So I was very struck by this, as something so ephemeral and so necessary to life that should be described as so very tough. So I wrote this little poem afterwards. Pollen. And this dust survives through the deaths of ages. It sleeps in deep layers of mud, black, red and umber. It sleeps under the wet pelt of a November hill, where long grass is the colour of fox. It sleeps deep under lakes. 12 meters down it survives. The dust of Arctic meadows, old and tough as love.
Yeah, I love that final line, or those final two lines there, old and tough as love. It touches on something that you've suggested, even in the quality of pollen itself, that something so important could be so old and tough as described to you. That a poem can hold contradictions, and not just opposites. Maybe, as you talked about earlier on about the poem that talked about 13 views, it can hold several different opinions, if you like.
Yeah. Because I suppose most of the time we're pretty conflicted beings. Well, I am anyway. I'm always terrified of being stopped in the street, you know, with a vox pop and saying, "What do you think of this?" Because I go, well, on the one hand this, and on the other hand that. And a poem allows you to do that. It gives you the freedom to look at it. And sometimes we live contradictions. You know, we feel I should do this, and yet you find yourself walking in quite the opposite direction. And I think, I suppose when I suppose that was part of the consolation and interest I found when I started to, like most people who write poetry, started as a passionate reader of poetry, the way it looked at many sides.
Your 2011 collection then, Hands, dealt with and certainly recalled your own very difficult encounter, I would have thought, with skin cancer. You wrote at one point there about your hospital experience, "Each of us alone with all our fears in our arms." Could have been written in the last year, really, couldn't it, that line?
I suppose so, yes. It's been a terrifying year for many people, and I've known people who have just had the terrible grief of talking to their brothers or their parents in the windows of hospitals. It's been an extraordinary, extraordinary year.
And has that begun to make its way into the work, do you think, for you?
It has, yeah. I've written a number of poems which relate to that directly or indirectly, actually. I think anybody who's writing at the moment can't but.
Has to be there.
None of us are untouched by it.
No. And I leave, there's a kind of a certain quality of that in the final poem you're going to read to us. But I want to briefly mention your most recent collection, Donegal Tarantella. I know we spoke about this back in 2009. And it really is, it explores your lifelong interest in music and the way music can carry story and history.
Oh, yeah, it carries the inner roads of our hearts really are expressed there. And I think it's particularly important for, I remember myself, the years between 16 and 22, when you just didn't seem to fit into the world very neatly at all. You know, it seemed the wrong shape. Somehow the music again expressed that, all of those contradictions.
Yes.
And in a much more eloquent way than anything else.
Yeah, sometimes I'm listening to a song, then you felt, there's somebody out there who understands me. It really did cover that period.
I'm not the first. somebody's been there. Somebody survived. Here's the evidence.
Yeah. We'll finish up then, as I said, with you have a handful of new poems just at the very end of this new collected poems, Moya. This one has a real resonance to the current moment, and I suppose possibly a resonance to where you're at in your own life. "Delete Contact Card."
Yeah. Okay, I'll read that now. "Delete Contact Card. It's happening more often now. Going through my contacts list, I find the name of an old friend, a decade or more older than me, with whom I spent sunlit afternoons laughing and talking about life and poetry, and I don't delete the card. As though a computer list could hold a soul for a month, a year or more in some limbo or bardo. Rain falls on the red bushes, the talkative postman still delivers books and letters, and with a small thump, a goldfinch lands on the window feeder. Life does go on without the dead, and no matter how much we wish it, we won't ever know for certain whether or not the dead watch over us. Own cards await deletion. What we do know now, better than we used to, is the worth of that honeycomb of hours spent laughing and talking, the sun-washed, unwasted hours of human contact."
Moya Cannon with her new poem, "Delete Contact Card," which is at the end of her current publication, Collected Poems. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Moya, and congratulations on the publication.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you. Good evening. Bye-bye.
Bye now. That's Moya Cannon, and Moya's Collected Poems is published by Carcanet Press. Released 25 years ago this month, The Score by the Fugees was a rap album for everyone, thanks to its three massive hits, Fugee Lad, the Roberta Flack cover Killing Me Softly, which topped the charts in Ireland for 2 months. The Score had gone 6 times platinum by October 1996. And yes, I did say three massive hits, Fugee Lad, the Roberta Flack cover, and this.
Gun blast, think fast, I think I'm hit. My girl pinched my hips to see if I still exist. I think not, I'll send a letter to my friends. A born again hooligan, only to be king again.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you.
There we go. Ready or Not, one of the huge hits from The Score, the Fugees album, that was released 25 years ago this month. The Score is raw storytelling, Wycliffe Jean writes in his 2012 memoir, Purpose, an Immigrant Story. Our recordings were pure, no tricks in sight, and it connected with music fans around the world. One of those music fans was Kate Brennan Harding, who is here with us this evening to talk about The Score. Was The Score your connection point, Kate?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? It was lovely hearing Moya talk about the connection that music has, especially between the ages of 16 and 20. And you guys talking about that. And that's exactly when I discovered it. I was 15 and it became the soundtrack to my junior cert year, you know, the entire summer. And you'd done your first state exams. And it was kind of such a beautiful album. It's such a vitally important album as well. But I was kind of hooked in from the melodies. I'm one of those people that I always hear the melody first. And once it did that, then you start to hear the darker themes and the fact that they're talking about resilience and resistance and being refugees. You know, they're bringing that into light. And for that reason, it sort of captured me even more then.
Well, that brings us to the Fugees. That's the title, first of all. Tell us a little bit about the origins of the band and the origins of the name.
Sure, yeah. So there's Lauryn Hill. And there's Praz, and they were in high school together in New Jersey in America. And then Praz's cousin is Wycliffe Jean, and they came together in the late 80s, and they originally formed a group called Translator. And from that, they started to form, I think, their lyrical and musical identity. They were really into rhymes and beating off each other. And when they decided to call Fugees, it was a nod to their Haitian. Wycliffe Jean and Praz are cousins, and they are of Haitian. Well, Wycliffe Jean is Haitian. And how a Fugee was sort of like looked down upon. It was derogatory, and they just reclaimed it. And they wanted to sort of empower. It's like, you know, this resistance of people who are, you know, going, they're displaced people, and they wanted to empower them. And the message that comes across in The Score is all about empowerment and just standing tall in where you've come from and in your history.
And is it very different that this, their second album, The Score, was the Fugees' second album? Is there a big difference between that and their debut, Blunted on Reality?
Yeah, I mean, Blunted on Reality is a classic kind of hip hop album. It didn't get any traction, really. And it's amazing that because it didn't get any traction, the record label still backed them. They saw raw talent, and the record label gave them, I think it was about $140,000 to go off and make The Score. And they did that in the basement. They bought recording equipment and they did it, you know, basically they recorded in a basement, and they took a couple of months in 1995 to record something. And to elevate their sound, they brought in more melody. They were always kind of jazz infused and Caribbean influences, obviously. Mm. And you get doo-wop influences now on The Score. But what they started to do really was Lauryn Hill. She was only 20 when this has been recorded. Lauryn Hill's vocals. I mean, her singing voice is just, it's just so sweet and silky. And then she's got this kind of edgy rhyming way about her as well. And she, I think, it was a perfect storm. The three of them were brilliant, but she just absolutely commanded attention, center stage. She was brilliant.
The mix of a melodic, a very strong melody and rap wasn't groundbreaking, but were they doing something new with that mix? Were they doing it in a way that opened up, talked to this idea that it was a rap album for everyone. Did they open rap up maybe to a wider audience than it had previously, or was that their aim at any rate?
I don't know if that was their aim. I know that they wanted to be successful because who doesn't want to be? But if you're thinking back to 1996 and we're thinking back to hip hop back then, it was East Coast versus West Coast. It was all very aggressive and it was all, you know, materialistic and that entire scene. And then you get Ireland where we have Richie Kavanagh's Éin Focaleira, we have Oasis, we have Boyzone. These are all number ones in 1996. And then suddenly we have Killing Me Softly. And that was an access point hugely for like all ages as well, because it was a well-known song. And I think that what they managed to do through like the melodies that they've, the sampling is amazing. Like the doo-wop sounds from the Flamingos. They have, they've sampled their own heroes, A Tribe Called Quest. They have brought in all these melodies. And I think that in itself just, it brought them outside of the just hip hop sphere, of the just R&B sphere, you know?
And as you said, putting in Killing Me Softly really, I suppose, helped them help audiences of or listeners of all types of ages to identify with this very young band at the time. Let's have a listen. Strumming my pain with his fame. There you go, the Fugees and their version of Killing Me Softly from the album The Score, released 25 years ago this month. And Kate Brennan-Harding speaking to us about the album on this, is it a Thursday evening? It is a Thursday evening. We played Ready or Not earlier on, Kate. There was a bit of a run-in with Enya over that song.
There was, yeah. Basically, they used the sample from Boadicea. And they didn't get permission. And when Enya and Enya's people heard, they threatened to sue. And they did. There was some sort of action, but it was settled outside of court. And Enya got royalties, obviously, and she got, you know, credited on the album. But the Fugees really thanked her and were really grateful to her, because Enya just thought that they were gangsters and thought that they were out to make a quick buck, and then realised that the intention behind what they were doing. So there was it was kind of ended in a friendship instead of in animosity.
And the differences were settled. It was a huge success, Killing Me Softly. Topped the Irish chart in Ireland for two months. Yeah. Do you think, I know it's hard to possibly answer this in some ways. Was that Roberta Flack? Well, she is responsible for that, really, as the Fugees were. Because that was an incredibly popular song in its day.
Well, I mean, Roberta Flack is credited for obviously making that song huge, but it actually was Laurie Lieberman who wrote the song. And, you know, it's based, you know, just looking at Don McLean kind of thing. But for me, that the Fugees' Killing Me Softly, that video, the song, Lauryn Hill's vocals, that stand out for me. And I prefer it to all other versions. And I think that it was an accident in how it was created as well. Like, they wanted to do something that was a bit more kind of edgy, but they weren't allowed to by the original writers of the song. They weren't allowed to change it. So they released that. So it was an accident that sort of catapulted them into this huge fame that I don't know if they were ready for either.
Was it sustainable then, that, you know, the fame that they got and the intense creativity that was needed for The Score?
No, I don't think so. And I think it's evidence in The Score is there has been their last album. Do you know, the three of them, I think, came together in perfect harmony. There was a relationship going on between Wyclef Jean and Lauryn Hill as well. And that ended badly because Wyclef Jean was having an affair with her. And I think that it's one of those, it's just they were in perfect sync for that perfect moment in time. And they created this absolutely perfect hip hop genre defining album.
A little bit of Fuji La to finish with. Is that really the blueprint for the entire album?
Completely. They even name check and reference some of their own tracks on this song. It's completely the blueprint for the album. Maybe one day I'll write the horror. Blackula comes to the ghetto. Jackson Acura. Stevie Wonder sees crack babies. Becoming enemies in their own families. I'ma get and come in the world we soon done. Gun by my side just in case I got the rum. A boy on the side of Babylon trying to front like you're down with Mount Zion.
You need a wee bit of La 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 before you finish up, don't you? That's Fugees and Fuji La from their 25th from their album The Score, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this month. And thanks to Kate Brennan Harding for helping us celebrate that very anniversary. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.